The subtle beauty of the Iowa landscape may seem plain and a little vanilla to some, but you don't have to leave Iowa to find a very different landscape that's wild, beautiful, and untamed by glaciers. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The glaciers that once covered our state gave us rich topsoil and a land so welcoming to farmers. But this hour, we'll go to northeastern Iowa to explore the area the glaciers skipped with the filmmakers behind the new documentary, Decoding the Driftless. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Tariana Ball of New Orleans. She's the lead singer of the group Tank and the Bangas, winners of NPR's 2017 Tiny Desk Contest. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with Tariana Ball, the lead singer of Tank and the Bangas, the winners of NPR's 2017 Tiny Desk Contest. They'll be playing in Iowa in just a couple of weeks. But first, in many ways, the Iowa we know and love today was shaped by glaciers. The glaciers that once covered our state smoothed things out and gave us rich topsoil. But the glaciers didn't cover all of Iowa. Northeastern Iowa is part of a region called the Driftless, an area that includes part of Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and a little bit of Illinois. It's a fascinating and beautiful area that the glaciers skipped. This hour, we'll explore that area with the producers behind the new documentary, Decoding the Driftless. And with me right now is George Howe. He's one of the co-producers of the documentary, a biologist based in La Crescent. Hello, George.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, happy to be with you and a lot of cold Iowans today.
Yes, it's pretty chilly. Tim Jacobson is also with us, also co-producer of Decoding the Driftless and an environmental attorney based in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Tim.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. And I want to start with how this documentary came about, because the two of you have been involved in a filmmaking journey before in creating a documentary called Mysteries of the Driftless, but you wanted to further explore the area. So tell me a little bit about this documentary and how it came into being. And I'll let you start, Tim.
Okay, so George Howe and I worked together in the past doing land conservation throughout nine counties in southwestern Wisconsin, and we just realized that we got to see and experience so many cool parts of the landscape that a lot of people don't necessarily get to see, and just incredible scenic vistas, rare plants and wildlife, cool archaeological features in the landscape, and we said, this has got to be the subject of a documentary film, and so we started making our first film, Mysteries of the Driftless, back in 2011 and released it in 2013. And we were just thrilled with the response we got from that film, and we decided we had to move forward and make a feature-length film about the Driftless area, and that's how we got started.
Okay, well, you guys worked together on that first documentary, but you brought in some outsiders for this documentary, Rob Nelson and Jonas Stenstrom of Untamed Science. So tell me how you connected with them. And George, I'll let you tell that part of the story.
Well, yeah, we Rob Nelson, actually, we did work with him and Untamed Science on the first film, too. But this time, Jonas Stenstrom, who's from Stockholm, Sweden, also worked with us. We also collaborated with Neil Reddick, who's a world-famous cinematographer. And so the creative team was somewhat different this time. Of course, we also were working under a completely new nonprofit called Sustainable Driftless, with new board members and new advisors, and there were a number of other things too different about this film. The first film, because it was a short documentary, we just couldn't fit that much in, and it was a pilot film. We wanted to see how people would respond to something like this, and the response was so positive and overwhelming that we knew we had to do the feature-length film, and cover more things, like, for example, the Mississippi River and the Flyway and all the fabulous resources therein are covered in this second feature-length film, whereas we didn't have time to do that in the first pilot.
I thought it was really interesting when I started the film to hear the voice of Jonas Stenström, who, as you mentioned, is from Sweden. It was interesting. He narrates not just as the narrator, but as a person from the outside experiencing the Driftless for the first time. Did you feel like having that kind of outsider's perspective was valuable to the film, Tim?
Yeah, definitely. We wanted to be able to kind of show it through the eyes of Jonas Stenström. And Jonas has worked with Rob Nelson, Untamed Science, for years. And actually, when we went about making the first film, he showed up in, for the initial meeting we had to talk about the idea of a Driftless film way back in 2011, but then he wasn't involved in that production. And so when it came time to make this feature-length film, we said, hey, we got to get Jonas involved. And he was very excited to come back and to explore the Driftless and be part of this film. And we think it's so important because a lot of times people who grow up in this area, spend their whole lives here, maybe don't appreciate it as much as they should. We hear over and over from people who grew up in this region that and then move away and they come back and they say, you know, I just took it for granted all those years. And now that I moved away and came back, I see it through different eyes. I have a different perspective and I appreciate it more. And so we thought by bringing in Jonas from all the way from Europe to be the director and kind of on-camera lead and narrator of the film, that that really lended a great perspective.
Absolutely. Well, one of the first things that you do in the film is you take Jonas and Rob, you take them up in an airplane so they can see the area from the air, which gives us a really different perspective on the Driftless region. What can you see from the air that you can't see from the ground, Tim?
Well, I've been a pilot now for, I don't know, about 14 years or so, and so it was thrilling to be able to take Rob Nelson and Jonas Stenström up in the plane and to explore, because it gives you a completely different perspective. One of the things that I think is most striking about getting up in a small airplane is that distances seem, everything seems so much closer together. And you know, from one side of the Mississippi River to the other, you know, it's all, you're taking it all in at once. You're seeing the connection, the relationships between different communities and different landscapes. And so being able to get a view from the air is really important. And it also was critical in our film in terms of showing kind of the, you know, how this region formed and why it looks the way it looks in terms of the bluffs, the rugged river valleys, the steep topography that is really highlighted well in the film because of the aerial work we did. And we were thrilled to be able to use multiple types of aircraft for the film. You know, everything from using a helicopter, Darlin Power here in La Crosse, let us use their helicopter for doing filming. We spent hours and hours zooming through the valleys and over the river, and it was just an amazing experience. And then getting up in different fixed-wing airplanes and also using drones. So we think it's visually spectacular and that the viewers will really enjoy it.
It is visually spectacular. And one of the things, and this was an observation made in the film, but it was really striking. As soon as the observation was made, you know, I think all viewers have a little epiphany looking at the bluffs. When you're driving through the region or hiking in the region, you know, each bluff, each hill is sort of its own exciting new adventure. When you get up in a plane and look at the area, you can see that all of the bluffs are roughly the same height, which is really striking. Tim, why is that so important?
Well, maybe George would be a better one to talk about
that. George can talk about that then.
Yeah, that's something we really wanted to point out early on in the film, and it's always been a desire of mine to explain to people how the Driftless got to be the way it is. All other efforts that I know of to describe the Driftless to the public and educate, you know, they always say, well, the Driftless is the way it is because the glaciers missed it, but they never talk about what it is. So we wanted to go back a half a billion years and describe, you know, why we have the layers of rock in the bluffs that we do, how it was mostly flat here at one time, and then how it got carved out by water over 3 million years. So that's one of the cool things about, you know, being up in the air, is you can see this, you know, the flat ridges and bluff tops, and how they're all the same height, and how it was at one time, you know, mostly flat, and then water carved out all these valleys. It's kind of an epiphany, you know. People, when they see that, then they get it. They go, oh, yeah, I get it. When I'm down in the valley, like, you know, La Crosse or Decorah, I'm down in a giant gully, and it's the ridge tops that are the former ground level, you know, the normal ground level. The valleys are all carved out.
Well, and it's important to contrast that with other areas with rocky topography. I mean, if you go to a mountainous area, that area was developed geologically over those millions of years in a completely opposite way, right?
Yes, and, you know, this is something that we really wanted to address in this film that we didn't have time for in the first pilot, and I think it's done beautifully. We have geological experts from UWL and Winona State and University of Wisconsin-Madison that just do a great job. And we spent a lot of time thinking about how to present this so that the average person would not only get it, but would be, you know, tickled by learning it. They'd be interested in it. And I think we nailed it.
Absolutely. So mountains are the result of an uplift, and the Driftless region has been worn away over time.
Yeah, and it's called inverse topography, and Dylan Blumentritt from Winona State really did a good job explaining that, and I think people are going to get it like never before.
Well, I certainly did. I was expecting, when I watched the film, I thought, you know, I'm going to learn a little bit more about things I already knew about. But I learned a lot of new things in this film, and I was surprised. But that was definitely a major aha moment. When you've watched the film with audiences, do you hear people gasping and getting it, George?
Yeah, we hear a lot of things. We hear laughter. We hear surprise. We hear people whispering to their, you know, their neighbors, this is really fascinating. So I tell you, it never gets old. You know, like with the pilot film, showing that to thousands of students and, you know, dozens and dozens of different groups. This film, we've started showing it, and we've seen a much more dramatic reaction even. And
well, we're going to take a short break. We'll talk about some of the other things we learn about in the film in just a moment. We'll hear some moments from the film as well. With me today, co-producers of the new documentary Decoding the Driftless, George Howe is a biologist based in La Crescent, Minnesota, and Tim Jacobson, an environmental attorney based in La Crosse, Wisconsin. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the new documentary called Decoding the Driftless. And with me are co-producers of the documentary, Tim Jacobson. He's an environmental attorney based in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and George Howe, a biologist based in La Crescent, Minnesota. And this documentary explores the Driftless region that covers part of northeastern Iowa, a little bit of Minnesota, a little bit of Wisconsin, a little bit of Illinois, a fascinating and beautiful area where the glaciers did not shape the land, although there are some side effects from the glaciers that certainly did shape the land that you explore in the documentary. But you wanted to make sure, George, in this documentary, that not only did we see this beautiful landscape, and it's really easy to take incredibly gorgeous pictures of the Driftless region, but you also wanted to make sure that we learned about the really, truly unique things about the Driftless region. Tell me just a little bit more about that vision.
Yeah, well, you know, for many years, working as a scientist and an educator, you know, I kept hearing and seeing that people that lived here or visited here didn't really understand, you know, how this area was formed or how unique it was. In fact, in some cases, they believe the exact opposite. Like, I can't tell you how many times growing up I heard adults or people like try to teach me that glaciers carved out this region. And, you know, I believed them for a while until I went to college, and Cal Fremling at Winona State taught us that the exact opposite was true, that the glaciers missed this area, and it was carved out by water erosion over millions of years. So, and I've always been naturally curious about why things are the way they are, so I've always had a desire to share things that I've learned with other people because, you know, I see it enrich my life to know the story. Because the more you know about something, you know, it just awakens even deeper curiosity and a desire to investigate more. And I've always seen that that makes me appreciate something more. And I wanted other people, you know, especially students, to be able to go through that process too.
Well, let's listen to just a little moment from the film when you're exploring an environment called an algific talus slope. Let's listen to just a moment.
Oftentimes, when you're just driving through the Driftless and you look at the bluffland regions, goat prairies kind of look like bald spots in an otherwise forested habitat. But these bald spots are very ecologically unique. There's a couple of characteristics that define the goat prairies, and the most important.
That was not the clip that I was intending to play there. That was more about the goat prairies. So I do want to talk about the algific talus slope, which is such a unique part of this region. George, can you explain what an algific talus slope is?
Well, it's a very rare kind of a micro ecosystem, a rare habitat. And where the bluffs are composed of fractured limestone, and the air can actually air and water can move through them, you get this phenomenon where ice gets frozen in the bluffs in the winter, and then air moves through spring, summer, and fall. It's taken in up higher in the bluff, and it moves through, and the ice in the bluff cools the air down, and then it comes out vents about halfway down the bluff. And so I always tell people the bluffs are actually breathing cold air, you know, all through the hot summer and even into fall. And it changes the environment there. Naturally, you know, only certain plants can survive or thrive, and animals too, where there's this cold air coming right out of the bluff. So in those areas where the cold air comes out, there's virtually no trees. There are some special plants like the federally endangered northern monkshood orchid, which is a beautiful purple flower that's pollinated by bumblebees. And it's just fascinating to watch. There are rare ice age holdovers, these Pleistocene snails, that it's one of the only places on Earth that they live. These algific talus slopes, there's a few of them also in the Appalachians, but besides that, the Driftless area is the only place on Earth where they have ever existed. So, you know, bluffs breathing cold air. It's like the bluffs are a living thing and creating these super rare habitats. And we have a wonderful treatment of this in the film where we journey in through a veritable jungle on a super hot summer day, plenty of bugs, mosquitoes, and after miles of trudging and fighting our way through, we get to this spot that has air conditioning, and it's quite a story.
Well, and so air conditioning, I mean, you actually stick a thermometer into this area where the bluff is breathing and measure the temperature. How cold is the air that's coming out?
Well, much to our surprise, it was way colder than we thought, and it's not rehearsed in the film that I am shocked, because the air coming out was like 24, 25 degrees Fahrenheit. So it was well below freezing. And this is, you know, in the middle of hot summer. I think it was 95 degrees that day, and we were all soaking wet with sweat. I had been to Algefic Tal Slopes numerous times. In fact, Tim and I were part of a conservation effort to permanently purchase the land and protect the only Algefic Tal Slope in Wisconsin that's permanently protected way down in Grant County. And I thought, well, let's take a thermometer this time because, you know, I know it's about, you know, 40 degrees. It's got to be above freezing because everything's warm. The ice inside the bluff is probably 32 degrees. It's melting. So we were shocked when just at the surface, you know, just the everyday alcohol thermometer, we put it in there, pulled it out, and it was way below freezing. So
yeah,
that was a cool moment, and that's what a lot of this film is, you know, real-time adventure. It's not rehearsed. And that's what makes the film so good, is that it's not scripted, it's not rehearsed. You're seeing real reactions. We're doing stuff that's never been done before, like other things in the film, like banding peregrine falcons, you know, hanging over the edges of, you know, rock faces, you know, being filmed in 4K. You know, that kind of stuff has never been done before. But yeah, the Algefic Talus Slope segment is one of the very, very unique, cool things in the
absolutely
film.
Well, and
cool,
one of the
literally
things that, yeah, one of the things that makes it so striking is that I think it would be easy to hike through this area and have no idea that you're in such a unique ecosystem.
Yep.
Because you might feel a cool breeze and think, oh, well, that's surprisingly cool, but you can't see what makes this area so unique.
Yeah.
I want to play a clip. This is from another part of the film. This is where you're having an incredible adventure in the incredible cave system that is underneath the Driftless region. We'll just play a little clip from that.
Just want to remind everyone what we're actually standing on here. Check this out.
17 miles of tunnels under this.
Having seen this spring resurgence and knowing what it is like inside this cave, how vast, how beautiful the formations, whenever I see another spring, I have the same thoughts and visual emotions that come and just flood me with what is that cave system like. There are a lot of cave spring resurgences in the area, some of them with higher flow rates of water that are exiting out. And that only leads you to believe that the cave system is even larger than this cave system. And this one is already at 17.2 miles so far.
All right, so you explore some of the caves below the Driftless region. And Tim, I'll let you talk about this a little bit. I think it was shocking to me to understand that there are so many caves underneath the Driftless region and that there have to be so many caves that we don't know about, because to discover the cave system, and people had to dive through a cold water spring to get into the cave system to explore. Tim, paint a picture for me of the kinds of caves that have developed under the Driftless.
Well, it's truly spectacular. And in northeastern Iowa, where we did some of the cave filming, was just amazing. And these huge huge caves, I mean, like it says in the film, you know, they're big enough you could drive a train through some of them, and you've got these underground rivers pouring through and bubbling out as springs. And you know, we got to see places where there's these amazing springs and waterfalls in northeastern Iowa, some really cool spots, especially kind of in the general Decorah area, these incredible places like Malaphony Falls and whatnot, where the springs are just gushing out of the sides of cliffs. And you know, we don't even know what's back underground in those places, but we can only assume that there has to be a massive cave system for all that water to be moving through, so it's gushing out and forming those beautiful waterfalls. And so it was just remarkable. And in the one cave that we show in the film, or one of the caves we show, you know, we actually had to crawl down a metal shaft 100 foot straight down.
That had been drilled to get to the cave system.
Right, because the only other way to get in the cave would be to free dive or dive through ice-cold water, basically, under a cliff, and then to try to, you know, wiggle our way in, and that's been closed off for safety reasons quite a number of years ago. But, yes, yeah, so they managed to drill this hole down, this shaft down to the cave, and crawl down 100 feet, and then, you know, this amazing, beautiful rock formations, cave formations in there, and to see and experience that was really remarkable. And then we also explored other caves, including one in Wisconsin, where it's known for its very tight, squeezy spots. And so I got to experience a little bit of claustrophobia, which it's shown in the film.
Yes.
It's really remarkable. One of the tight spots of the cave is known as the birth canal, because you have to wiggle through such a tight space, and there are lots of spaces like that in there. And so really remarkable, you know, and we really challenged ourselves as filmmakers going in and exploring some of these things, really pushing the boundaries of our own personal comfort levels at some point. And but it was spectacular, beautiful, mysterious, and I think people are just going to love seeing and learning about that.
Well, and again, looking at the region from the air gives us information about the kinds of caves that might be underneath. And again, it's something that we can look at it and it seems quite mundane, but then if you understand what you're seeing, it's spectacular. And that is, when you look over the fields of this area, you see little areas in many of the fields with trees. So there's a little green patch in the middle of a cornfield, etc. And those are sinkholes, right, George?
Yeah, those are the clues that there's something different going on underneath. There are parts of the Driftless, like the Iowa-Minnesota border, where there are thousands of these sinkholes, little depressions on the surface where the ground has sunken in or sometimes collapsed because of the caverns underneath. And it all gets back to geology. And that's why we wanted to first in the film explain, you know, go back a half a billion years and explain, you know, how this area used to be under a tropical sea, and these marine deposits were being laid down for hundreds of millions of years. And then those later, when the continents drifted northward and sea levels dropped, those became the layers of sedimentary rock in the bluffs. And some of those layers are limestone that slowly dissolves away with weakly acidic surface waters. And so in some places, you get this like Swiss cheese of partially dissolved away sedimentary rock layers that if it's near the surface, then you get sinkholes, and then underneath you get passageways and caves and caverns and underground rivers, and it's called a karst topography with a K. And, you know, some people know we have it here, others don't. It creates really cool things, but it also creates a situation where you really should understand the land if you're going to live on it and be good stewards of it, even manage it safely for the public. You know, for example, in southeast Minnesota, a community once built a sewage treatment lagoon on the land. They didn't investigate the geology underneath, though, and after a few years, this whole sewage treatment lagoon, you know, millions of gallons of sewage water went down a sinkhole and into all the aquifers and everyone's drinking water. Mm. So this is cool stuff, but it's also huge consequences for people's health and lives and livelihood. And so there's so many layers of good, important things that comes with knowing where you live and how things formed and what's there now.
Now, we only have about a minute left. I came away from watching this film with a new appreciation for the Driftless region and a desire to explore the region as well. What else do you want people to take away from this film, Tim?
Well, I think it's really important for people to know that although it's a documentary film, it's a film of science, it's really, we infuse it with adventure, humor, and showcasing the incredible scenic beauty of the area. So it is so much fun. I mean, it was great when we premiered the film to more than 1,000 people in La Crosse recently. And, you know, to hear the audience laughing and enjoying it, it is not like your typical documentary. This film is a blast to watch, and people are going to enjoy it so much.
And what do you want them to walk out of the theater and think about in the future? I mean, obviously, people are excited. What's next? What's the next step, George?
Well, we're trying to create that spark of interest that they want to learn more. And, you know, once they're turned on to the unique stuff that's here and get excited about it, they are going to find time in their life to go to that spot, hiking or kayaking or to read that book about the area or go on the internet. So, you know, we want them to just start or continue a journey of exploration, awareness, and concern and love for this beautiful area they live in. And we want to mention that at the Rivoli Theater in La Crosse, starting October 19th, the film is going to be showing. So for a whole week, starting on October 19th.
And people can find more information about that showing and future showings on your Facebook page, Sustainable Driftless Incorporated. I'm sure there'll be many other opportunities to see the film as well. George Howe and Tim Jacobson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Co-producers of the new documentary, Decoding the Driftless. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tank and the Bangas, an American funk and soul music group from New Orleans, won 2017's Tiny Desk Contest by NPR by unanimous vote. And when you listen to them, you instantly know why they blew the judges away. Tank and the Bangas is coming to Iowa. They'll be playing at Codfish Hollow in Maquoketa on Tuesday, October 30th. And lead singer Tariana Ball, much better known as Tank, is on the line with me now. Hello, Tank.
Hello. That's a nice one.
Thank you so much for being here. And I find, you know, I just said American funk and soul music, but your music kind of defies categorization. How do you categorize it?
Yeah, that was like a really limited musical influence, because we're influenced by so much, and we always make sure that we incorporate that into our making of music. We just know that we always have the power to make whatever we want, and we don't really put it in a genre. Just feels good.
Now, you actually are a poet. You did slam poetry when you were growing up?
Yeah, I did. It taught you, I don't know, people are going to judge you no matter what. So, you know, you just kind of have to go out and really do this no matter what, because that they were always going to be judging you. Just in poetry and in slam, they actually did it right in front of your face. After you did your poem, they would hold up a paper with a scale of 1 to 10 on it, and you got judged.
Wow. How old were you when you started doing that?
The first poetry contest was high school, so probably 15.
Had you done other kinds of performing before the slam poetry? Because you seem like you were born to be in front of an audience.
That's crazy, because it can feel quite natural in that way. But I remember the first time I ever had to perform, it was at my grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary, and I performed a poem, and I screwed it up so many times. I really did. But my grandmother must have saw something in me. She brought me around to every church after that, and I would do the same poem until I memorized it, until I got it right. But she saw something in me, and then I kept going because of it.
Was that a poem that you had written, or were you performing someone else's poem that first time?
I never forget. I was performing someone else's poem. It was A Great Somebody by Adrian Hardesty.
Can you give me a few lines of it?
Wow! I am a serious child. I am a serious child with serious goals. And if it takes hard work to reach my goals, I will do it. I am a clean someone. I know that if I lie down with hope, that I will come up with mud. I know to keep my mind, my body, and my character clean. Like, that was one of the lines.
Oh, wow. So when you started doing slam poetry, I that must have felt so vulnerable to be up on stage performing your own words and being judged by people. What was it about that experience that really spoke to you?
Oh, wow. I think doing it with a team. Like, you always knew that your team had your back and that, you know, they supported you and that you practiced. Like, because when Slam, we were practice all night. And I think what really gave me the confidence was seeing teams from, because I started off with HBO's Brave New Voices. Oh, and I was inspired by poets from Deaf Poetry Jam. And so Brave New Voices was like the kid version of that. And I was around all these children from all around the world, London, Hawaii, New York, California, and they were just amazing. And they were really serious about their craft and going there every year. You just were always, you wanted to compete to be the best, and you wanted to compete not only to be the best, but to touch the people that the people had, because children were touching you. Like, they were putting fire underneath you and making you cry and feel things that you hadn't felt before. It's a place to be in. It's really special.
When did that start to evolve for you? Your music is still clearly very strongly influenced by that spoken word tradition, but when did you start gravitating toward music and turning it into such a musical arrangement?
After I was with Brave New Voices, I started slamming with the adults, and we formed a team in New Orleans called Team Snow, which stood for Slam New Orleans. And being from New Orleans, we were such a musical city, we started singing with all our poetry, you know, and we would make little songs before we presented our poems, or in the middle of our poem, we would have a song, we would hum, just always musical influence, always. That team made me have a love for putting my poetry and the music together.
How old were you when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans?
Probably like 15 or 16.
Okay, so you were displaced by Hurricane Katrina at the same moment when you were really developing your voice as a slam poet. How did that affect you?
It was really hurtful because I was meeting up with friends, my poetry friends, writing every week. And, you know, it wasn't like I had this, you know, amazing life at school. So, you know, being with these other kids on the weekends, going to go write at coffee shops, that was a getaway for me. When Katrina happened, I wrote about it constantly, and that was therapy for me. Thank God for writing, because I wrote so much. I was replaced for one of my best friends and, you know, and my sisters, which are, you know, really big influence in my life. So that was really hurtful. But thank God for poetry. And I actually had to learn how to be, you know, this completely different person, because I relocated to Indianapolis, and I didn't have any friends, so I had to make them. I had no clothes, so I had to create some type of style for myself, which honestly probably came more from within than anything else. And you kind of had to meet yourself somewhere else, and that can be a scary, defining and beautiful place, because you'll find out some things that you didn't even know about yourself.
I want to talk a little bit about your style, because that's such a big part of what we see when you perform. You have an extraordinary style, and you seem to have so much fun with the clothes that you wear, and you seem to be so comfortable. But you say you didn't have any clothes. Of course, I mean, I'm sure you lost so much in Hurricane Katrina, but you also hadn't really developed that personal style because you had always worn school uniforms, right?
Right. New Orleans is big on school uniforms, so, you know, that was definitely a thing to do. There's always diving for clothes inside of this one room that they had for all the anybody that was affected by Hurricane Katrina, that you could just go and, you know, look for clothes for yourself. And if I'm at a school where they're wearing regular clothes, you know, I'm like, I'm so scared, because I'm like, I don't got no clothes to wear.
Yeah.
But these children had always been wearing regular clothes, so something that they showed me was that it didn't matter. You know, like, who cares? So I kind of took on that same attitude.
Well, you didn't just dress like everybody else. I mean, it sounds like you were really inspired by what you could find at thrift stores and used that to stand out.
Yeah, but I wasn't really standing out in high school. I was just trying to get by and have on a nice pair of jeans and a shirt and just go to school looking decent and clean. It probably was when I actually came back home and, you know, and it still didn't have much and came home to the thrift stores and, you know, because I always wanted to do it, but I just didn't really know how. I went thrifting with my other sister. I had like three of them, and she helped me pick out one thing because I didn't really know how to do it too well. And after that, it became a thing. She gave me a big shirt, a couple of ties, and I was like, okay, this could be a star for me for a moment. And after I started performing, it just started getting a little more intense. I've actually calmed down a lot. I've seen some of my old pictures, and I was a wild girl. I've really calmed down. I really have.
Well, I just spent some time watching a really incredible interview that you did about your style and your body image. You were asked to take part in a project where women talked about their style, talked about their bodies, and actually took off their clothes as part of this interview. And you were so open and so vulnerable and real about your relationship with your body. Why do you think, now that you have shared that part of yourself, why do you think it's important for a woman in your position to speak out about that fraught relationship so many of us have with our bodies?
Man, that was I remember when they called me for that, and I was really excited to do it because I was like, oh, I'm talking about, you know, clothes and fashion and body. I mean, great. And then they were like, well, Tank, have you seen our videos? I was like, no. They was like, before you agree to this, you need to check out our videos. I was like, okay. And I went to check him out, and I was like, oh, my God, the girls are taking off their clothes. Oh, Christ, I can't do that. Nope. I'm like, that's really intense. I'm not going to do that. And then I just had to think about it for a while, and I was like, you know, like, how could I not do that? I have to do that. I have such a story, and I know that I'm not the only one that's been feeling this way. So I had to share.
Now, tell us a little bit about your story.
I mean, just being a black woman in America, I mean, you're so defined by how you look and how your body shape is. You know, that's for every woman, but even more so in the black race. And I say that because, I mean, you literally came to America and you sat on the auction block and you got extremely naked and someone picked you, determining how strong or how fit or how, you know, appealing you were, so that you can work or literally be taken advantage of sexually. And that has been passed down in the minds of Americans and African Americans, you know, in history. And because of that, our women do extremely extreme things if they're not already born with nice hips, small waist, big breasts, big behind. They will literally go to the hospital and make sure that they get that so they can continuously be in the running to be a wife, a girlfriend, or just accepted by society in a way where people can say, damn, she looks good, you know? So growing up with those type of, you know, pressures that you see around you, you begin to, you know, you want that, and you want your clothes to fit you a certain way. And if I'm growing up as a young black girl without the things that I feel as though are needed to gain attention and to get a husband and, you know, to basically even have your clothes fit like you want them to, you know, it's something that can live with you and stay with you. So I knew that I wasn't the only woman that felt like this, because my friends will feel like this. You know, a lot of people would, and I just wanted to shed light on them to let them know that, you know, that they weren't alone. I probably had one day in my entire life where I felt completely invisible, because I really don't normally feel that way. And I don't want girls, I don't want women, I don't want nobody feeling that way. It feels really bad to feel like nobody looking at you, watching you, or thinking that you're special or beautiful or awesome. It doesn't feel good. So I don't want anybody to feel that way. So I'm doing it as an awareness, you know, that you're not alone. And that it is normal to feel that way, but I want to normalize feeling a different type of way as well. And that's accepted and beautiful, you know, sexy, because everyone still won't get sexy.
I want to talk about when you won the Tiny Desk Concert back in 2017, March of 2017. That has been a pretty big life-changing event for you. You've been performing around the world ever since. How has that changed your life?
It's exactly what you said. You know, like we've always traveled and we've always, you know, had this electric show that nobody knew about but the people that were there. And kind of that just kind of gave you that platform, you know, that everybody needed to see. Every artist, if you're working hard, needs that moment to remind you why you do this, to remind you that you can actually live off of this for life.
So that was your big breakthrough moment, but you're an incredibly hardworking band. I mean, you've been doing the festival circuits. You've been everywhere. Is there a hard part of this as well? Because, again, I mean, life changed. People were turning out in bigger numbers to see you in places where you thought they wouldn't have heard of you. But you're also on the road all the time. Has that been a real challenge for you?
Yeah, it has. You know, because once you're never home in New Orleans, you start to realize how special New Orleans is and how you want to be home, and you start realizing how absolutely how much you even love your family. You know, I mean, you always have, but you're like, wow, every moment with them is even more precious than before because you know you're not with them as much. And I have a good time with my band. We have a great time. I mean, I love being with them, and they're really actually a bunch of cool people. But it's nothing like New Orleans. It's nothing like, you know, being at home. And that's probably the most thing that I won't miss.
I think about that 15-year-old girl that got driven away from home by Hurricane Katrina and had to make her way in a brand-new kind of environment. When you are standing up on stage performing, if there's a 15-year-old girl out there watching you, what do you want her to know?
I would say exactly what I would have told myself, that she's the S-H-I-T, you know, that no matter what, that this world is yours just as much as it belongs to the Beyoncés and the Taylor Swifts of the world, that you're no different in that sense, that you're just as this is amazing. This is special, and that you know, if you haven't tapped into your potential or who you are, you find out what that is, so that you can go and live big and then brilliantly and brightly.
Well, you are making incredible music. You are spreading a lot of joy. Tank, thank you so much for talking with me today.
No, thank you. You're so cool.
Tarianna Ball, she is the lead singer of Tank and the Bangas. They won NPR's 2017 Tiny Desk Contest, and they'll be performing at Codfish Hollow in Maquoketa on Tuesday, October 30th. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
Possibility, throwing pennies down the wishing well, hoping and wishing. Merry monkeys just to look at me, look how quickly I can climb a purple tree. I'm a gymnast, chemist, centrist, mathematician. You should look at me, look at me, I'm great.